Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today. And, Jim, we start with news that actually happened a couple of days ago, Friday to be specific. This is the Los Angeles Times story. Attorney General Jeff Sessions asked Friday for the resignations of dozens of politically appointed U.S. attorneys held over from the Obama administration. Sessions wanted to, quote, ensure a uniform transition, unquote, to the Trump administration, according to spokeswoman Sarah Isger Flores. Until the new U.S. attorneys are confirmed, the dedicated career prosecutors in our U.S. attorneys' offices will continue the great work of the department in investigating, prosecuting, and deterring the most violent offenders, she said. The order affects 46 U.S. attorneys. 47 others have already stepped aside. 93 U.S. attorneys are the top federal prosecutors in 94 districts. Goes on to say it's not unusual for a new administration to seek the dismissal of political appointees, particularly those of a different party. In March 1993, then Attorney General Janet Reno sought the resignations of U.S. attorneys appointed by President George H.W. Bush. Attorneys general under Presidents Obama and George W. Bush generally tried to stagger departures over a few months to help with continuity. Jim, the one name that's getting most of the attention is Preet Bharara, the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, not only because he's doing pretty good work in nailing Democrats in Albany, New York, but also because he was apparently told by Trump back in November that he wanted him to stay on. So he refused to resign, and ultimately he was fired. So on the one hand, it's good to get rid of some of the Obama influence in our justice system. There's probably still too much. But it's always fun watching the media hyperventilate over something that every other president in recent memory has done.
I'm not surprised to see the usual media voices hyperventilating about this. It's a night of the long knives, you know. I'm not surprised that almost nobody remembers the Obama administration's turnover in U.S. attorneys. I'm not surprised that everybody, like, Bill Clinton firing the U.S. attorneys was a really big deal amongst conservatives and Republicans on talk radio and places like that in 93, 94. I realize this is ancient history. I realize the millennials and the news media don't remember this, but this was a big deal. But we were saying, hey, President Clinton has the authority to do this. So stop whining, stop complaining. He's perfectly within his rights to do this. So now Trump does, you know, a very similar move. Oh, it's a panic. We may remember the seven U.S. attorneys who were fired by the Bush administration who were considered to be, oh, my goodness, it's this partisan politicization of this. Back in the first term of Obama, and I did the numbers, and about half of the U.S. attorneys that Obama had appointed had either donated to his campaign or the Democratic National Committee or some similarly lined or aligned organization. And the world generally yawned to this. Greg, no one appreciates me. No one understands the brilliance of my journalism. But the argument, the general, well, look, the president's, you know, U.S. attorneys are inherently politically appointed positions. And we can argue about whether this should be the case. We should argue about whether there's kind of too much discretion about in the types of laws that a U.S. attorney will enforce. Although let's point out, the U.S. attorney isn't a one-man operation, right? There's career federal prosecutors working under them. And it's not like when you toss out Preet Bharara or any of the other figures that all of a sudden, like, you know, all cases stop, right? Usually there's some sort of general transition process for this whole thing. And most years, most cycles, this goes on and nobody notices that all of a sudden – it's not like they suddenly said, oh, we're not going to prosecute insider trading anymore. Everybody's off the hook on that. So there's a lot of, you know, typically partisan hand-wringing and, you know, furrowed brows and all that stuff. And I think, you know, one of the reasons this qualifies as a good martini is how quickly most respectable media were willing to point out, you know, one, he has the authority, and two, this isn't that unusual or different from what other presidents have done. So I think that there is a great desire to, you know, construct a narrative of the runaway, out-of-control Trump Justice Department. But this is pretty much par for the course. We can argue about this is the way the Justice Department and U.S. attorneys' offices should operate, but there's nothing different. The other thing is interesting, whether Bharara turns into a potential Democratic candidate someday down the road. It is worth noting that he is a worked for Chuck Schumer years and years ago. Most people saw him as a pretty darn driven crusader who was not afraid of stepping on Democratic toes. in his position as the U.S. attorney for the Lower District of New York, which covers New York City and all of the enormous, powerful figures in there. Something of a rising star, something of a guy who's, you know, kind of get the impression of somebody who's ready to clean up the town of Albany. It's quite possible that he's got political ambitions. But that's, you know, that will wait for another day. I think that this is, you know, kind of a necessary step on the part of the Trump administration. And I think the rapid action on this front, maybe it's a good way to spotlight what we're going to talk about in the bad martini.
Yeah, there's 93 vacancies now, and let's see how fast he can fill them, and hopefully with quality people. But the pace of filling vacancies has become an issue. This is the New York Times, which I believe, Jim, has declared virtually every nominee thus far to be the worst ever. But nonetheless, they're worried that there are so many unfilled positions here. At the State Department, the normally pulsating hub of executive offices is hushed and virtually empty. At the Pentagon, military missions in some of the world's most troubled places are being run by a defense secretary who has none of his top team in place. And at departments like Treasury, Commerce, and Health and Human Services, many senior posts remain vacant, even as the agencies have been handed enormous tasks like remaking the nation's health insurance system. Further down, it says the lag has left critical power centers in his government devoid of leadership as he struggles to advance policy priorities on issues like health care, taxes, trade, and environmental regulation. Mr. Trump has won confirmation of 18 members of his cabinet, and he has not nominated anyone for more than 500 other vital posts and has fallen behind his predecessors in filling the important second- and third-tier positions that carry out most of the government's crucial daily functions. As of Sunday, he had sent to the Senate 36 nominations for critical positions, just over half of the 70 sent by President Barack Obama, who was also criticized for early delays at the same point in 2009. So, Jim, there's obviously a lot of positions that have gone, forget unconfirmed, unnominated at this point. Trump has made statements from time to time saying he doesn't think we need all these positions to be filled, but a lot of them are pretty important, and time's a ticking here.
Yeah. My fear is that this is going to turn into a monthly story for the Trump administration. I had a chance to dine last week with some folks who were looking to work in the Trump administration and who were very much sympathetic to the Trump agenda, very much wanted to see the administration succeed, and were just kind of expressing great frustration at this. And you can point to both cabinet official type level positions, but would require Senate confirmation. And you can point to ones that simply sounded like White House staff positions that were still waiting to be filled. Couple of different places where this could be slowing down. You can point out there's some claim that the FBI background checks are taking a while. I'm sympathetic to this in January, a little less sympathetic in February. Well, we're heading into mid-March. April, we're 50 days in. The 100-day deadline is coming down the pike. I went down this. I'd have to check my updated list. But Greg, I believe we have not seen a nominee to be the new director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
I think that's right.
You'd think that'd be a really high priority, considering the great frustration and high, prominence of this issue in the Trump agenda. I believe Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, considering the strong support of the National Rifle Association and the frustration with the Obama administration on this, you'd think he'd want to get his own people in there as quickly as possible. Some of them are FEMA, maybe Trump is comfortable with Obama's person in charge of that. You can even imagine a couple scenarios where you might want to keep the Obama holdovers in place. So if anything goes wrong, they're a very convenient scapegoat. But by and large, if you really feel like the deep state or you feel like Obama holdovers are a major obstacle to the Trump agenda, well, guys, the simplest way to do that is to get your own people in there. And in some of these cases, can you say that the Senate, dragged their feet in a lot of cabinet secretaries? Yes. I don't think you'll see the Senate Democrats prioritize these lower level folks. And the second, in a lot of these cases, they just haven't nominated anybody. And you have this nagging feeling the administration doesn't quite realize the sheer volume of these folks and the importance of these folks. And this is, like I said, this criticism isn't just coming from the typical left wingers and folks who want to see Trump fail. I think what this carries a lot more weight because this complaint is coming from people who want to see Trump succeed. Hopefully we'll see some movement on this. I think, in a situation where if the Senate's taken forever, that's one thing. If you haven't nominated anybody by mid-March, that's on you, Trump administration.
Yeah, a lot of this should have been hashed out during the transition time, and you would think that if you trust your cabinet secretaries, they are probably experts in the field and have pretty good ideas who some of these people ought to be. You still want to have your own stamp on it because it's your policies, it's your administration and so forth, but you would think that that would be one way to get some good names towards the top of the list. But anyway, let's move on to the third martini now, and over the weekend, there was quite the dust-up internationally between the Netherlands and Turkey. Let's try to summarize this with the help of hot air. Taylor Millard is the one doing the writing here, although this story, I believe, is from Dutch news. Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte on Sunday described actions of the Turkish government in sending a minister to Rotterdam, despite being told she was not welcome, as extraordinary. Minister for the Family, Fatma Betul Sayan Kaya, was stopped from entering the consulate in Rotterdam when she arrived on Saturday night, prompting a standoff lasting several hours. Riot police were drafted in to clear the area near the consulate, which had been declared a no-go zone by the mayor there earlier in the day. In total, 12 people were arrested and 7 people, including 6 demonstrators, were injured. Basically, what's going on here is that the Dutch government has elections coming up on April 16th. They don't want riots and other things stoking the fire and influencing the vote so close to Election Day. And that's very much sketching out the issue. There's a lot more detail we could go into. But the crazy martini is not that. It's the reaction of Iowa Republican Congressman Steve King to the Twitter machine, where lots of trouble starts. Geert Wilders, of course, is the Dutch politician who very much does not want to see Islamic influence overrun the Netherlands. And so he has said that he wants to de-Islamify the Netherlands. So here's where the King tweet comes in. Wilders understands that culture and demographics are our destiny. Next sentence is where the trouble comes in. We can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies. So, Jim, I think a lot of folks perhaps maybe get an idea of where he's coming from. A lot of times when you think about the American melting pot, people come from their other countries, and while they keep aspects of their culture, their food, sometimes other customs, they come here because they want to be American. There's something about American that they love, and now folks come and they don't necessarily want to assimilate into America. But the idea that certain babies, meaning whether it's race or culture, religion, whatever, by definition, can't be American or can't help to restore the civilization is taking it way too far.
Yeah, look, I think you put it very well, Greg. And, you know, anytime David Duke is applauding you, just stop. Just kind of, you know, and probably say, no, that must have come out wrong because I don't want that SOB applauding anything I say. Because when he says we can't restore our civilization with somebody else's babies, Greg, that's pretty much the way we've done this since the founding of the country, right? I mean, like the waves of immigrants, Ellis Island, you know, we have. Now, if you want to argue about the need for assimilation or the need to kind of stir and inspire a faith to the American creed, and like when I say that, I don't mean the literal religious creed. I mean our values, our ideas, our system of government, the reverence for the Constitution, which, let's face it, plenty of native-born Americans aren't all that instilled with these days. That's fine, but it seemed like a very separate conversation. His phrasing was just about as bad as he possibly could have made it. Unless you put the word Heil in there somewhere, I really can't think of a way to have made it worse, because one, we can't restore our civilization. I guess you could debate about what the state of our civilization is in. I think there are times on the right we vastly overstate this narrative of collapse. In today's Morning Jolt, I touted Christopher Caldwell's brilliant piece on the opioid addiction crisis, and yes, we have very serious problems, but I don't think American civilization or Western civilization is on the verge of collapse. Secondly, the idea that somebody else's babies. I mean, you're not just like, you're not just saying other people are the problem. You're saying other people's babies are the problem. Now, I might argue the moment you're attacking babies, you've dug a hole and stopped. Stop, turn around, go back. You're not going to know. Babies are never the problem. Babies are cute and cuddly. If anything, babies are the ones who are going to be much easier to instill the American creed into because there's nothing they need to unlearn. There's no old habits or traditions or ways of thinking they have to get rid of. They're perfectly ready to be Americans right here and now. We just got to teach them correctly. We just got to instill our values in all of them. And I think we've done that pretty much throughout our history for a really long time. We can have you might argue that the public school system has really fallen down on the job in the past generation or so, but I don't think that's I don't think you say based on that, well, we need to stop letting people into this country because we can't teach them anymore, right? The answer is to fix the school system and also do all of our part to instill these values in everybody else. So anyway, this is one of the, Steve King is perhaps not my favorite Republican. I just would like those who are in districts where they usually win by 20% and they're really, really safe districts to remember how they sound to districts that aren't so safe. That basically, it's a unfair game the way the media will now go to every single Republican and say, hey, do you agree with Steve King? And every Republican is going to have to distance themselves from it. It's the rerun of the Todd Akin playbook. But you know what? That is the media world we live in. And so you have to try to avoid saying things like saying, I don't like those babies over there. Those babies aren't our civilization. Those babies can't really be American. Because, one of the concepts is that anybody can be American if they buy in, so to speak, if they buy in psychologically and in their philosophy and things like that. Now, if you're like, nah, I'm really a big believer in ISIS. I really believe that there should be no separation of church and state. And I believe that we should be a theocracy. Well, okay, then you're incompatible with America. Then we got every reason to keep you out because you can't mesh with us. You're not going to play well with us. If you're same way we did when you were a communist or things like that, there are ways to have this conversation. Maybe Twitter's 140 character limit is going to be inherently problematic when we try to have these discussions. But Steve King did not do anybody a favor with this. And, you just kind of hope that, look, these are important issues. And this is not the sort of area where you want to shoot your mouth off because you're going to play into every negative stereotype the Republicans have been fighting for generations.
You know, I'm really not a big Austin Powers fan, but I'm going to quote it for the second time in just the last several days here. I think it's actually in the third one, which is a terrible movie. Don't ever watch it if you haven't. But Michael Caine shows up as Austin Powers' dad, and he's Belgian. And one of his great lines, and I'm paraphrasing probably here closely, is, if there's one thing I can't stand, it's people who have no respect for other people's culture. And he takes a pause and says, and the Dutch.
Yes. There you go. And, that's this. You come across as the bad Michael Caine in that in that tweet, Congressman. So hopefully he'll backtrack, rewrite it, emphasize, clarify that, and that you won't see any David Duke applauding any more Republican tweets for at least a while. Right, Greg? Is that setting the bar too high? Is that too much to ask?
No, I think our other bad martini is that David Duke got his Twitter privileges restored because he had been banned there for a while, but apparently he's out of Twitter jail.
Yay.
Jim, on that note, talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and be sure to tune in again on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.